From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. On today's Fresh Air, Ethan Coen joins us for a mini retrospective of his films. Ethan and his brother Joel wrote, produced, and directed Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, Fargo, and The Big Lebowski. Ethan Coen has written his first book, a collection of short stories called Gates of Eden. Also, an onstage performance and interview with Tracy Nelson. In the late 60s, she became famous as the lead singer of the roots music band Mother Earth. On her latest CD, Sing It, she trades lead vocals with Marsha Ball and rhythm and blues great Irma Thomas. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Reports from Israel today indicated that negotiators could be getting closer to a peace agreement, but that news was contradicted by the White House this morning, which said Israeli and Palestinian negotiators have not worked out a peace agreement. NPR's Ted Clark reports there is pressure on all sides in the Mideast peace talks to reach a deal, if only to give the leaders of the United States, Israel, and the Palestinians an opportunity to direct their attention to other issues.
American officials who are mediating these talks say they cannot go on forever. The Israeli delegation says the prime minister needs to get back to Israel because the parliament, the Knesset, is open. So these talks cannot go on forever. But both sides appear serious, according to White House spokesman Joe Lockhart. And as long as both sides appear serious, they're going to keep trying, at least for another day or two.
NPR's Ted Clark at the talks in Wye River, Maryland. As tensions rise in Kosovo, Britain's foreign secretary is in the neighboring Balkan nation, Macedonia, meeting with Kosovo's Albanian leaders and the Macedonian government. Jennifer Glass reports.
Britain's foreign secretary visited Macedonia's border with Kosovo, patrolled by a UN observer force. And standing less than a mile from Serbian territory, Robin Cook issued a stern warning to Yugoslav President Slobodan Milosevic. The international community, he said, will not stand by and allow Milosevic to mistreat the people of Kosovo. He said Britain and its Western allies have long supported the principle of Kosovo's independence. But Cook also had a warning for the Kosovo Liberation Army. He said he had no intention of allowing Kosovo to be ruled by gunmen. This week's alleged attacks by the KLA in defiance of the U.S. brokered ceasefire is something Cook will broach with Albanian-Kosovo negotiators at his meeting here in Macedonia. For NPR News, I'm Jennifer Glass in Skopje.
Scattered light rain is forecast across much of Texas today, which is a relief to the southern and central parts of that state. The region has been drenched with rain over the last few days. Larry Peabody is a meteorologist with the National Weather Service. Peabody says the runoff from heavy rain has no place to go.
It's all being channeled through these drainage systems down into the Gulf of Mexico. Well, these drainage systems are normally only about maybe 50 feet wide or 100 feet wide at the very most, maybe 100 yards wide in some areas. Well, due to the amount of water that's coming into these drainage systems, the banks just can't handle it.
At least 22 people have died from flooding incidents. 5 people are still missing. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is down nearly 44 points at 8,462 in heavy trading. The NASDAQ Composite Index is up nearly 2 at 1640. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the earnings news continues to come fast, with a big bank and some major airlines among those detailing their corporate bottom lines today. NPR's Jack Spear reports.
As this latest batch of earnings news hits Wall Street, it seems investors may be starting to get a little skittish. After 5 straight up sessions, the Dow Jones Industrial Average has pulled back some at midday. That is amid concerns that despite profit pictures that are brighter than investors had anticipated, there are also worries corporate earnings could slow during the final 3 months of this year. Companies detailing their quarterly earnings numbers today include Giant Citigroup, which says it earned $729 million during its latest quarter, a big drop from a year ago. UAL, parent company of United Airlines, says its earnings for the quarter came in at $516 million. Record earnings were also up at U.S. Airways. Earnings at multinational conglomerate DuPont were pretty much in line with expectations, down 54 cents a share. Jack Spear, NPR News, Washington.
The Senate has passed a $520 billion budget package that includes new money for federal agencies. The bill, which has been passed by the House already, weighs nearly 40 pounds. It was so big, few lawmakers had time to read it. President Clinton is expected to sign the budget. It provides money for new teachers and new police officers and funding for a missile defense system. The government reports that initial construction of new homes fell last month by 2.5%. It was the second monthly drop in a row. Building of new homes dropped off mostly in the South. It was that region's largest drop in housing construction in more than 1 year. This helped depress the national home construction rate. The construction for new homes had just reached an 11-year high in July. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from Borders Books and Music in more than 200 neighborhoods across the United States, where browsing is a fine art. 800-644-7733.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, booksellers since 1873. Online at barnesandnoble.com, AOL keyword BN. Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and from Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. Filmmakers Joel and Ethan Coen are famous for their quirky sense of humor and love of film noir. Their crime comedy, Fargo, won an Academy Award for Best Screenplay. Their other movies include Blood Simple, Raising Arizona, Barton Fink, Miller's Crossing, and The Big Lebowski. The brothers co-write their films. Joel is listed as director, my guest Ethan as producer, but they say that in reality, they share all the work. Ethan Coen has a new collection of short stories called Gates of Eden. We invited him for a mini retrospective of the Coen brothers' most popular films. Let's start with their first film, Blood Simple, about a betrayed husband who hires a shady character to kill his wife and her boyfriend. That shady character, played by M. Emmett Walsh, delivers the opening monologue.
The world is full of complainers. The fact is, nothing comes with a guarantee. I don't care if you're the Pope of Rome, President of the United States, or Man of the Year. Something can all go wrong. Go ahead, you know, complain, tell your problems to your neighbor, ask for help, and watch him fly. Now, in Russia, they got it mapped out so that everyone pulls for everyone else. That's the theory, anyway. But what I know about is Texas. Down here, you're on your own.
How do you go about plotting movies like Blood Simple when, you know, when there's the setup and things get complicated?
Yeah, we're really actually incredibly irresponsible about it. We just start writing at the beginning without an idea, without any idea really of how it's going to go. We don't, for instance, outline the script before we start writing it. We just sort of start in with the first scene and see where that leads, which is actually, oddly enough, maybe the reason things get sort of complicated. You end up painting yourself into corners if you don't know where you're going, and you perform weird contortions to get yourself out, which land you in odd places that, well, you certainly, and then hopefully the audience, never expected to find you in.
Your brother, I think, had been working on editing cheap horror films before you made Blood Simple together. Are there any particular shots or scenes or stylistic touches that relate to those horror films?
The best of the bunch was a movie by Sam Raimi called The Evil Dead, which had a couple of camera things that we just more or less sort of stole from Sam. One of them was just a really crude homemade method for moving the camera quickly without a camera dolly. But actually, you know, Sam's movie generally being the best of the ones that Joel worked on was something that we learned a lot from.
Is the shot that you're talking about that you borrowed from Sam Raimi that kind of really jumpy, fast? It looks like it would be a Steadicam shot, except it's really jumpy, and it's a really fast kind of, I don't know what to call it. It's not a zoom exactly.
No, it is just a fast track. You're right. Sam called it a shaky cam. It's a sort of homemade steady cam.
Right.
And what it is it's just a camera mounted in the middle of a 2x4, which one person grabs at either end and runs like hell with. So it has the, you can sort of clear obstacles, jump over obstacles, skim over or under, whatever. And it's sort of much more fluid than a lockdown track would look, a sort of standard dolly move would look, and more energetic. Largely because the lens is so wide. You have to use a really wide lens or it would become just unbearably bumpy.
Now, I think you used that shot when Frances McDormand is getting strangled in the movie.
Yeah, we did indeed, yeah.
Now, one of your movies, Barton Fink, is about a very pretentious playwright, played by John Turturro, who wants to write for a new living theater of and about the common man. And his successful plays lead a studio head to bring him out to Hollywood. And I want to play the scene where the studio head, played by Michael Lerner, welcomes Barton Fink to Los Angeles.
My name is Jack Lipnick. I run this dump. You know that. You read the papers. Lou treat me all right? Get everything you need? What the hell's the matter with your face? What the hell's the matter with his face, Lou?
It's not as bad as it looks. It's just a mosquito in my room.
Place okay? Where'd we put him?
I'm at the Earl.
Never heard of it. Let's move him to the Grand or the Wilshire. Hell, he can stay in my place.
Thanks, but I wanted a place that was a little less...
Less Hollywood. Sure, say it. It's not a dirty word. Say whatever the hell you want. The writer is king here at Capitol Pictures. You don't believe me? Take a look at your paycheck at the end of every week. That's what we think of the writer. So what kind of pictures does he like?
Mr. Fink hasn't given a preference, Mr. Lipnick.
So how about it, Bart?
Well, to be honest, I don't go to the pictures much, Mr. Lipnick.
That's okay. That's just fine. You probably walked in here thinking that was going to be a handicap, thinking that we wanted people who knew something about the media, maybe even thinking there was all kinds of technical mumbo-jumbo to learn. You were dead wrong. We're only interested in one thing. Can you tell a story, Bart? Can you make us laugh? Can you make us cry? Can you make us want to break out, enjoy a song? Is that more than one thing? Okay. The point is, I run this dump, and I don't know the technical mumbo-jumbo. Why do I run it? It's like a horse sense, damn it. Showmanship! And also, and I hope Lou told you this, I am bigger and meaner and louder than any other kike in this town. Did you tell him that, Lou? Coffee?
Ethan Coen, did you ever get a disingenuous introduction like this from a Hollywood studio head?
No, that's certainly not based on life. I don't know. I don't know that kind of character still exists anymore. Hollywood is a little more bland and corporate than that now. It's funny. I hadn't that. And actually seen the movie since we finished it. Hearing it was Michael Lerner's quite funny.
Michael Lerner's great, yeah. And of course, did anyone ever try to convince you that the writer is king?
No. In a word, no. No, nobody's that bald at any rate.
After your first crime film, Blood Simple, the crime films became a lot funnier. And I guess the most successful of your crime films is Fargo, in which Frances McDormand, your sister-in-law, plays Marge Gunderson, the chief of police in Brainerd, Minnesota, and she's investigating a couple of murders. She's also very pregnant. So I want to play a scene in which she's with another cop and she's finding bodies at the crime scene.
Here's the second one. It's in the head and the hand there. I guess that's a defensive wound.
Oh, yeah?
Where's the state trooper?
Back there, good piece, in the ditch next to his prowler.
Okay. So we got a trooper pull someone over. We got a shooting. These folks drive by. There's a high-speed pursuit. Ends here, and then this execution-type deal.
Yeah.
I'd be very surprised if our suspect was from Brainerd.
Yeah.
And I tell you what, from his footprint, he looks like a big fella.
You see something down there, Chief?
No, I just think I'm gonna barf.
Jeez. You okay, Margie?
Yeah, I'm fine. It's just morning sickness. Well, that passed.
Yeah?
Yeah, now I'm hungry again.
That's a scene from your award-winning film, Fargo. One of the things I really like about this film is that although the criminals are all actually pretty dumb, Marge, the police chief, who looks like she might be mocked in the movie, is actually a very good cop with a very big heart and very likable. I just really love the way you handle this character in the movie. Tell me about creating Marge.
Well, you know, it's funny you say that. A lot of people liked her, and I'm sure that's why the movie did well. I always thought she was the bad guy.
Did you really? Why did you think she was the bad guy?
I don't know. I just related to Steve Buscemi's character more. He seemed like the classic sane person in an insane land. Marge, definitely Fran's character, sort of embodying the insane land. I kind of found her a little bit alarming, as did Fran. We were all surprised, actually, that people liked her quite as much as they did. But, you know.
Well, tell me what you found alarming about her.
Well, she is definitely, I mean, there are admirable things about her, but she's also definitely sure of herself to an alarming degree. I mean, certainly not given to introspection.
Well, she doesn't eat very enticing food, I will say that. There's a great scene at the all-you-can-eat buffet in which she's, you know, loading up the plate with mounds of fricassee and mashed potatoes and fried balls of something or another.
Yeah, that seemed to sort of say it all, the track down the along the sneeze guard there with the Muzak playing.
Yeah, and I should say, the Muzak, I can't remember whether it's in this restaurant or another restaurant, where what is on the Muzak is the Burt Bacharach, Hal David song, Do You Know the Way to San Jose? And
thinking, it was that scene.
How much money did you have to pay for the rights to use the Muzak version of that song?
You know, Muzak isn't terribly expensive. The publishing, the rights to the song itself as opposed to the recording were expensive, but the recording itself was pretty cheap.
You really thought the Steve Buscemi character is the most sane, and it's Steve Buscemi who is actually hired to kidnap the wife so that people can collect the ransom money, and everything gets out of control.
Mm-hmm.
What did you write into the Steve Buscemi character that made him so likable to you and so seemingly sane to you?
Well, I'll tell you, in one respect, he's sort of an audience surrogate in that he's the one person who's not local. Even Peter Stormare, his sidekick, is not of the region, but he's Swedish, so in that sense he's connected to the region. So as a sort of alien in the landscape, he's who even dresses inappropriately for the climate. He's, again, a sort of outsider and audience surrogate in that respect. And, you know, there's just something sort of refreshingly chatty and direct about Steve, his character.
And you've worked with him in several films.
Yeah, several. And we always end up killing his character for some reason.
Does he resent that?
No, he hasn't complained yet. Maybe that's why we continue to do it.
What's your approach to casting been? Do you do the casting yourselves? You've worked with some terrific actors in your movies. You know, Nicolas Cage, W.H. Macy, Frances McDormand, M.M. Walsh. Dan Hedaya, one of his early roles was in Blood Simple. John Turturro, John Goodman.
Yeah, we've been lucky. We've worked with great actors. But it's, you know, anybody who, it's really a buyer's market for that. There are a lot more good actors out there than there are good parts. So if you write something that's interesting to an actor, you'll have good actors to choose from. And, you know, we sort of do, in terms of the casting, it's always been a mix with us of writing parts for specific people that we know, or sometimes that we don't know, but whose work we know, as was the case with Emmett Walsh in our first movie, and writing parts for whomever, somebody that we don't have any sort of specific actor in mind for as we're writing, which we then subsequently go out and cast.
How'd you know Emmett Walsh?
Well, he was one of the ones whose work we knew but didn't know personally. There was a movie that he was especially good in. It was a really good role, a movie called Straight Time that we'd seen, and that seemed, Emmett sort of definitely makes an impression in that one.
So you called him up and asked him to be in your movie?
Yep. It was about that simple.
And what did he say? I mean, you didn't have much of a track record yet.
No. We were actually really surprised that he agreed to do it. I'm not quite sure why he did. You know, in retrospect, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that we were shooting in Austin, Texas. It was a short time commitment for him, and he was going to be in Dallas anyway, working on a movie called Silkwood. So I think Emmett just figured, what the hell, I'm going to be in Texas anyway. But it was certainly a fortuitous thing for us.
Do you have a new movie in the works?
I don't know what we're doing now. For the first time, we've written an adaptation of a novel, which we've never done before. But since the novel is owned by a studio, our fate is a little bit out of our own hands. We're waiting to see if the studio will want to go ahead and let us make the movie.
What's the novel?
It's called To the White Sea. It's the last novel that James Dickey wrote. It's about a tail gunner in a B-29 who's shot down over Tokyo the night before the firebombing of Tokyo.
Well, Ethan Coen, thanks so much for talking with us.
Thanks.
Filmmaker Ethan Coen, he has a new collection of short stories called Gates of Eden. This is Fresh Air. We're all big movie fans here at Fresh Air, and we try to bring you interviews with some of the most interesting people behind and in front of the cameras. The movie theater I most often go to costs $7.50 a ticket. I pay it. I don't try to sneak into the theater. You don't have to buy a ticket to listen to public radio, but it's kind of like sneaking in if you rely on other listeners to support your station while letting yourself off the hook. Please call now with a pledge. Thank you. Rockabilly musician Charlie Feathers died this summer, a few weeks after a definitive retrospective of his work had been reissued. He was 66. Rock historian Ed Ward says he was an original.
When you walk down the street, I always take a peek, peeping eyes looking at you. I asked her for a date, she said a quarter to eight, though I was never late, but had another day. Peeping eyes, deep inside, peeping eyes, looking at you. Peeping eyes, wanted to cry, peeping eyes, looking at you.
On August 31st, 1998, America lost one of its most cantankerous, original, and obscure musical figures when Charlie Feathers died of a massive stroke in Memphis. He was a man who did everything in his power to fuel his legend every time a fan would show up at his house or one of his local gigs. How much of what he said was true? Hard to say, but he did leave a legacy of a couple of dozen records, which give us clues. Charlie Feathers was born in 1932 near Holly Springs, Mississippi, in extreme poverty, and worked in the Texas oil fields as a teenager with his father. He also played the honky-tonks there because he'd long been fascinated with black musicians and had taken some impromptu lessons from Holly Springs blues man Junior Kimbrough. At 18, he moved to Memphis to drive a truck and get into the music business. And before long, he was hanging out with the regular crowd at Sun Records.
You grew cold and acted smart. Won't you please defrost your heart? Fill this tray with the love, sweet and warm. Melt the ice and snow away. Let the sun shine in to stay. And then the love that is tattered and torn. I love you more than I can tell. So please release me from this spell.
Sam Phillips, who ran Sun, thought Charlie was a great country singer, and there's ample evidence for that on Defrost Your Heart, which sounds a great deal like George Jones, but predates him. Charlie, however, had other ideas. He stood by and watched Sun make stars out of Carl Perkins and his old friend Elvis Presley, and he watched Elvis have a hit with a song he and steel guitar player Stan Kessler wrote, I Forgot to Remember to Forget. Finally, he took matters into his own hands and recorded the kind of music he wanted to play.
Now let me tell you about my real gone chick. She's got a different style. And when she tries to talk to me, I always smile. She's tongue-tied to my rocking thrill. But I like to hear her say, well, me, Dot, put me more. 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 Me dot, put me more, when me dot you. Let's go!
Tongue-Tied Jill, many people think, should have been a huge hit when it was recorded in 1956, but Sam Phillips was apoplectic when he heard it, claiming it made fun of the handicapped, and it came out on Meteor Records instead. It only sold 919 copies, but that was enough to alert King Records in Cincinnati to Charlie's existence, and so later in the year, he made two more singles for them, one of which, One Hand Loose, is considered one of the perfect rockabilly records.
Keep away from the corner, say what I got to say. Hold one hand only, get the ready for a ride. Give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied. Give me free hand, baby, cause I wanna rock. Turn it loose and maybe I won't blow my top. Give me free hand, woman, let it swing up my thigh. Give me one hand loose and I'll be satisfied. Hello.
One thing was certain. Charlie Feathers wasn't some Southern kid trying to be Elvis. He was his own thing and confident in what he was doing. But again, the records didn't sell. King proposed a sound closer to Elvis's, and Charlie came back for two more records. Again, nothing. Charlie's regular band drifted away, but he continued to seek out opportunities to record. That he paid no attention to what was playable on the radio is evident in the shocking first line of his 1960 release, Jungle Fever. Since these were the same people he hung out with and learned music from, we can only put this down to naivete. After a bizarre stab at protest folk and a 1963 single for Holiday Inn Records, For Sale in the Lobby, Charlie Feathers' recording career came to an end. He continued to play honky-tonks and sent his son Bubba to study with Junior Kimbrough and warmly welcomed the first pilgrims to show up at his door from England, where Tongue-Tied Jill and One Hand Loose were holy grails of record collecting. He'd hector them about the nature of true rockabilly and how nearly everybody out there had no idea how to play it. In 1991, Charlie Feathers finally recorded again for the ill-fated Nonesuch American Explorer series, but his voice wasn't what it used to be, although his guitar playing was. And he was still Charlie, arguing with the drummer about the right way to play rockabilly. Perhaps fortunately, he was one of a kind.
Rock historian Ed Ward. All the music he played is featured on the Charlie Feathers 2-CD retrospective, Get With It, on the label Revenant. I'm Terry Grossen. This is Fresh Air.
Well, I kiss my baby and it don't seem right. Too many people been holding her tight. Well, everybody loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. But I need my baby. I should have seen my money, but it carries no while. And everybody loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. Everybody is a loving my baby. But I mean, but don't you see? They got you, boy.
That's got me.
Coming up, an onstage performance and interview with Tracy Nelson. In the late 60s, she was the lead singer of Mother Earth.
I just can't find another man to take your place. Now you know I love you, but that wasn't. Touch me the way you used to do, but it's not losing you that's got me down so low. I just can't find another man to take your place. I know
support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. Columbia Records, presenting the new self-titled album from John Mellencamp, featuring Your Life Is Now, available in stores. And Princeton University Press, publishers of The Shape of the River by William G. Bowen and Derek Bach, an examination of race-sensitive college admissions policies and their long-term consequences. In bookstores or on the web, pup.princeton.edu.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. We have something special for you, an onstage performance and interview with Tracy Nelson, a powerful singer who became famous in the late 60s as the lead singer of the roots music group Mother Earth. Over the past few years, Tracy Nelson has recorded a series of rhythm and blues albums on Rounder Records. Now she's featured with R&B great Irma Thomas and pianist and singer Marsha Ball on the CD Sing It. They trade lead vocals and sing backups for each other. Before we meet Tracy Nelson, let's hear a track from Sing It.
We start a fight. Who knows what for? Who knows who's winning? And who's keeping score?
Our Tracy Nelson interview and performance was recorded in Austin, Texas, at a benefit for public station KUT. She was accompanied by Marsha Ball at the piano. We'll feature Marsha Ball's concert and interview sometime soon. Tracy Nelson grew up in Wisconsin and loved rhythm and blues. She had trouble finding like-minded musicians when she moved to San Francisco in the 60s.
Because that was the psychedelic era. And nobody, you know, they'd say, what kind of music do you like? And I'd say, well, I kind of like blues. They'd say, oh, go hear this blues band at the Matrix. They're really great. And it'd be the Grateful Dead. And when I was in Wisconsin, I went every weekend to Chicago and heard Muddy Waters and Howlin' Wolf and you know, that's what I meant when I said blues, and wasn't really what they were doing out there. And R&B was just out of the question. There was just nobody doing R&B.
Now, you had already recorded an album, I think, by the time you got to San Francisco. You had an album in 1965.
Yeah.
And what? How did you, I think you were still in college, how did you manage to get a record so young?
Well, it was like everything else that's ever happened in my career. I don't know, it was a fluke. I was at a party, met a guy, liked my singing, and said, let's, you know, we can do a record.
Who'd you meet?
Sam Charters.
Well, he's not just a guy. Sam Charters has produced a zillion blues records and written books about the blues and, you know, traveled the South rediscovering blues musicians.
It really had to do, I was at that time doing some kind of folky stuff with Johnny Kalb, who was Danny Kalb's brother, who was in the original Blues Project, and they came through town. Danny was doing a show, and then we went to a party afterwards and sat around and sang. And Sam seemed to think that I could do something. So, and that was a very acoustic, kind of traditional blues thing.
How did you find the musicians in the band that you formed, Mother Earth?
Well, Doug's going to kill me for this. He's going to kill me. But, I mean, this is the absolute truth. We looked everywhere for musicians, and the man who was kind of acting as my manager then, was my manager for years, Travis Rivers, came to us one day and he said, it was me and another singer and a keyboard player, said, I found a great R&B section for you. They're great. They're from South Texas. They're you know, just what you want. And I said, well, how'd you find these guys? He said, well, it's Doug Somm's band. And I said, well, isn't Doug going to be kind of nerked off if we just take his whole rhythm section? And Travis said, screw him. He just ran off with my wife. That's the absolute truth.
So what has Doug Somm's reaction since then been?
He asked me not to tell that story.
I guess we'll leave it there.
Yeah. Oh, so, and we definitely got the better end of that deal. There's no deal.
No, the the person who you mentioned, Travis, who was your manager, he was also, I believe, the person who, you know, discovered Janis Joplin.
Well, he didn't really discover her, but they were kind of friends.
Mm-hmm.
And
friends in the 60s term?
Yeah. And he brought her up to San Francisco from Texas originally, but... Uh-huh. That didn't last long.
So was there ever the suggestion that you were being marketed as, like, the next Janis
Always.
Joplin?
It worked in my favor to a large degree because I was nobody. I mean, I had just threw some people together, and I was doing a kind of music that nobody was really doing out there. And thanks to Bill Graham, we actually got some gigs. But still, we'd play, and people would say, oh, that's okay, but you're no Janis. But the... the record companies were, all of them, looking for another Janis, the next Janis, their Janis. And for Mercury, who gave me my first contract, very quickly, I mean, within a year or so after I moved out there, I had a record contract, which was absurd. And that was their hope, and I think they were bitterly disappointed.
Well, you're so different than, I mean, she was really such a kind of shouter singer, whereas you're a singer. I mean, not which isn't... To put Janis Joplin down in any way, but I mean,
it's apples and oranges for sure.
Yeah,
and I never heard any similarities at all. But I understand why they thought I could be that because I'm loud. So.
Well, did that also give you the sense that you were supposed to be this kind of like sexual figure of fantasy in the way that she was? That you were supposed to have this like erotic relationship with the audience the way she did, because she really did. I mean, that was her thing, having this like erotic relationship with the audience. Yeah. And that's a lot of, like, oh, you're the next Janis, so you got to get on stage and do that too.
You know, I didn't think about that much at the time.
That's,
and
just
glad
as well,
I didn't.
Yeah.
No, I mean, that never crossed my mind. I'm sure you're right. I'm sure that was part of the expectation, but again, people were bitterly disappointed.
The band was named Mother Earth, and it was named after a Memphis Slim song that was a song that the band did. Let me ask you to do a few bars of the song.
Yeah, okay.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you can hide happy all the time, and you may never come my way. Mother Earth is waiting for you. There's a debt you've got to pay. I don't care how rich you are. I don't care what you're worth. When it all comes down, you've got to go back to
This song is, of course, about how we all end up dead and in the ground, but did people somehow interpret it that as Tracy Nelson is an Earth Mother?
Yeah. And it really, you know, this is what, when you start a band, you work up shuffles and slow blues because it doesn't take any rehearsal at all. And you want to get out there and do a gig as quick as you can, so you don't want to waste a lot of time rehearsing. So you just work together a blues set. And so this is one of the first things we pulled in, and one of the guys in the band, and I'm sure they came to regret it, said, "Oh, this would be a great, you know, band name." Immediately it drew attention to me being the only woman in the group and just detracted from them. And there was another singer, Paul St. John, who was a brilliant, brilliant writer and a wonderful singer. And, you know, he got kind of eclipsed with that. And people started thinking I was like Mother Earth. And, you know, that's a heavy burden. One I never asked for. And when people would come to my house and think I had a commune, and when I moved to Tennessee and lived on a farm, I would get up in the morning, there'd be people in my living room saying, "Oh, we're here to crash in your commune." And it did carry a lot of baggage with it.
We'll return to our onstage performance and interview with Tracy Nelson after a break. This is Fresh Air. Let's get back to singer Tracy Nelson, recorded on stage in Austin, Texas. You left San Francisco for Nashville in sometime in the 70s.
69.
Okay. Yeah. And so did that change your music? Did that lead you more toward country music?
I don't think so. I'd always sort of liked a little bit of country music. It was confusing. It probably put a kind of a stop to my career at
Why?
That point. Because I moved to Nashville, my records said, you know, recorded in Nashville. They went in the country bins. People, would, if they even bought them, would say, "Well, she don't sound country," and you know, it just confused people. And it about the time we had finally gotten enough attention to, you know, what I was doing and re-educated people, then I did that damn duet with Willie Nelson, with that damn Willie Nelson. Which is probably the single most successful thing I've ever done in my life, and I mean, it was a great song, but we just did it as a whim, and it was huge on the country charts. So that just confused it all over again, and from that point on, I've been, you know, you don't hear me describe without country being in there anywhere. Now sometimes they say country blues, and you know, that's Charlie Patton, you know, that's not me, but. But it did confuse the issue pretty much.
But you have recorded a bunch of country songs.
Oh, yeah, and right after I moved to Nashville, I did an entire album of country tunes, so that probably pushed it right along, too.
Well,
just, know, go figure.
Just to show off that part of your repertoire, maybe Marcia can come back to the piano and accompany you in maybe a few bars of a country song that you like.
Yeah. Actually, a song I used to do in my folk act was I'm So Lonesome I Could Cry, and then we cut it on that.
You hear that lonesome whippoorwill? He sounds too blue to fly. The midnight train is moaning low. I'm so lonesome I could cry. Did you ever hear a robin sob when the leaves begin to die? That means lights up the purple sky, and as I wonder where you are, I'm so lonesome I could cry.
That line, have you ever heard a robin sob? I mean, God, what a line.
You dropped out of music for a while, I believe.
No.
No?
I just quit recording so nobody knew I was playing music.
Why did you quit
my
recording?
My profile dropped.
Was it your choice or was it the music industry's choice?
No, it was the music industry's choice. It was the 80s and, you know, I couldn't get right with the 80s and nobody wanted to record me, so I just went out and did gigs when I absolutely had to and stayed home the rest of the time.
I want to recommend the records, the series of records that you've made on Rounder.
Mm-hmm.
Interesting choice of songs on there, too. Yeah.
I highly recommend it.
Yeah.
Well, God bless Rounder. I mean, you know, I really got drugged back into it, kind of kicking and screaming. I mean, the producer that I did the first two records with, Tommy Goldsmith, just went to Rounder, and everyone kind of said, okay, yeah, you better make a record. And I was really still not kind of thinking, oh, I can't do what I want, so I don't want to do it. But they let you do what you want. So,
has living in Nashville put you in touch with different songwriters? And
There are great songs. I mean, we mentioned one of them earlier, Gary Nicholson. There are great songwriters in Nashville. And the very successful ones write mostly for the country singers, but, you know, when they really write what they want to, they write these great R&B tunes, and Gary's one of them. I mean, you know, when he's just knocking them off, he and Delbert get together and just knock off these ridiculously wonderful tunes. Mm. And another person is Mike Reed. What does anybody know what position Mike Reed played for the Bengals? I think it was played. Oh, I like to say tight end, but I guess that's not right. So, you know, he's a defensive tackle, and he writes these, it's snotty of me to sound surprised at that, but he writes these exquisite tunes. He wrote I Can't Make You Love Me If You Don't for Bonnie, and I mean, I don't know if he wrote it for Bonnie, but she recorded it, and we did a song of his on the new album. It's called In Tears, and it was also co-written by Rory Burke, who's another just magnificent writer down there.
Tracy Nelson recorded on stage in Austin, Texas, at a benefit for station KUT. Her latest album, Sing It, on Rounder Records, also features Irma Thomas and Marsha Ball, who accompanied Nelson at our concert. From the CD, here's the song Tracy Nelson was just talking about, In Tears.
Thank you.
Tracy Nelson from the CD Sing It on Rounder Records. This is Fresh Air. The Tracy Nelson concert was a benefit for public station KUT in Austin. Tracy Nelson loves public radio. I know a lot of performers, writers, and artists who give their time or money to public radio because they know it's the place for music that doesn't fit into the latest commercial formats, and it's the place for in-depth interviews with people in the arts, entertainment, and the world of ideas. There's a price we pay for having this cultural oasis. It's the price of a pledge. So please call now with a pledge. Thank you. Let's get back to our onstage interview and concert with Tracy Nelson. She first became known in the late 60s as the lead singer of Mother Earth. On her final song, she'll accompany herself at the piano. I'd like to ask you to do another song from the Mother Earth era. And this is a song you wrote. It's a great song, and you sing it so well. And it's called Down So Low. And I know you've sung this a lot over the years, but I'd love to hear you sing it.
Well, I appreciate that. I don't usually do it. I mean, I usually have like a whole band with me to do it, and that's easier for me.
When you went away, I cried. That's gotten me down so low. starting to be. Cause a woman can't be a woman, don't you know, unless she is fulfilled. It's not losing you, no, that's got me down so low. I just can't find another man to take your place. There's no
a nice big drum crash.
What was going through your life when you wrote that song?
That's what I call one of my bad boyfriend songs. I mean, you know, what the hell do you think? I was in love with a guitar player who became quite famous, and he broke my heart, and I wrote this song, and it's the best thing he ever did. Musically, anyway.
Tracy Nelson recorded on stage in Austin, Texas, at a benefit for station KUT. We'll hear the other half of that night's benefit, a concert and interview with Marshall Ball, in the near future. Nelson, Ball, and Irma Thomas are featured on the new CD, Sing It. Our thanks to Roland Morehouse of KUT, recording engineer Dana Whitehair, and WHYY's Art Ellis. Our broadcast was produced by Danny Miller and Roberta Shurrock. Our engineer is Bob Purdick. I'm Terry Gross. On the next Fresh Air, we'll hear from Rabbi Burton Vizotsky, whose new book interprets the biblical story of Exodus, how Moses delivered the Jews out of Egypt in slavery. And we'll talk with the anthropologist who uncovered the tomb of the sons of the Pharaoh, Ramses II. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.